We are live here in the studios once again with Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon. This is so much harder when these headphones aren't working.
Yes, that's all right. I'll kind of self-direct from here. Right. I want to start out with talking about developments around CHOP, the Capitol Hill occupation protest over on Capitol Hill. Last weekend, as folks probably know by now, there was a shooting late at about 2:30 a.m. on Saturday night inside Cal Anderson Park, not actually inside the streets that form the CHOP, but right outside it in Cal Anderson Park. Apparently, an argument between two of the folks living there. One young man died and another was wounded. Both were transported to the hospital by protesters inside the zone because Medic One personnel staged themselves several blocks away from where the shooting actually occurred, and then they wouldn't enter the zone without a police escort. That is Medic One policy, in case people don't know that. And of course, protesters would not let police enter the zone. Police showed up later in a phalanx wearing heavy riot gear, and protesters pushed them away, said, no, you can't enter, and anyway, the victims have already been taken to the hospital. Now, it was initially reported that it was an attack by a white supremacist driving an SUV and shooting people with an automatic rifle. Now, I think the specificity of the details in that rumor was probably a big clue that it wasn't true, but that didn't prevent people from going crazy on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media and passing on misinformation. I just want to remind people, spot news, the very first reports of spot news, what we call spot news in the media profession, tend to not always be true. So when something like that happens, it's important to say, it's important to wait until you get eyewitness testimony or wait until you get what sounds like and feels like really authoritative information before you just pass on rumor like that. And I have to say, too, that the mainstream media wasn't a whole lot better in this instance. They jumped right in and used it as an example of the lawlessness of the protest zone. And they blamed protesters for not allowing that phalanx of heavily armored police into the zone to pick up the victims, even though the victims had already been transported to the hospital. Now, later in the week, there were additional shootings on Capitol Hill, and those shootings were not in the protest zone and not in Cal Anderson Park, but that didn't prevent the local media and Seattle police from still attributing those shootings to the protest zone itself. I want to point out, too, that these shootings may have occurred because the Seattle Police Department appears to have abandoned a large swath of lower Capitol Hill, not just the protest zone, to patrolling and not be doing their best to try to tamp down on criminals who may be using the protest zone as an opportunity to commit crimes. And I think that that's something that the mainstream media and that the city has not been pushing the SPD on. Now, members of and I also should say that historically that's often been the case with the Seattle Police Department. When they're angry at protesters, they have a tendency to take it out on the neighborhood of Lower Capitol Hill. And that may be why Shama Sawant keeps getting reelected to the city council. One of the key reasons is because that neighborhood really feels like it it's often the scapegoat for anger that the SPD has towards the community, not just the LGBTQ community, but in particular to lower income communities and communities of color in Seattle. Now, members of the Durkin administration have been going down to the protest zone to meet with protesters, sometimes on a daily basis. Mayor Durkin, however, is not one of those people. Even Chief Carmen Best has met with protesters, I think a couple of weeks ago. SDOT director, Seattle Department of Transportation director Sam Zimbabwe has been down there multiple times to negotiate opening up some of the streets so that residents and businesses can get access to their homes and workspaces. Personnel from Seattle Public Utilities, from the Fire Department, from the Parks Department have all been to CHOP to negotiate and set up sanitation and provide services for the growing homeless population in Cal Anderson Park. And I want to point out that that's a population that's been getting bigger by the day because, and this is a very simple reason and very easy to understand, but one that apparently the mainstream media can't parse. The reason is because Mayor Durkin's navigation team continues to sweep homeless encampments all over the city, even during the pandemic, even after the mayor said that she would not sweep homeless encampments. Those sweeps have been continuing, and Cal Anderson Park is really the only no-sweep zone in the city right now. So, of course, it's going to attract a large homeless population.
I know Erica Barnett wrote about that, I believe, during the last week about that, where the mayor had previously said they'd done 15 sweeps, and then Erica
it's actually
dug into
closer
it, it's like 60.
It's actually closer to many, many times that, five times that. Now, Mayor Durkin, who had so far refused to even mention CHOP when questioned by the media. Instead, she would talk about, anti-racism and racism in policing nationwide. She'd kind of talk about the broader issue. She would not even mention CHOP, even with when directly questioned by the media. She finally started to talk about it this week after the shootings. She announced early in the week that the SPD would soon be returning to the East Precinct, and that CHOP would be dismantled by the end of this week. This was not just because of the shootings, I should point out. On Wednesday, a group of apartment and condo residents, business owners, and companies that own property inside the CHOP filed a lawsuit in federal court against the city, saying that the Durkin administration has not only done nothing to ensure their safety and access to their homes and businesses, but has supported the protesters by providing services like porta-potties, trash pickup, street barricades, and water hookups. And of course, that is all true. But I should point out that some of the businesses who are parties to the lawsuit and who are claiming that CHOP has destroyed their businesses were not allowed to be open anyway in the past few weeks because of the governor's COVID-19 order. That includes a tattoo parlor and several bars in the Pike Pine corridor, and possibly also some of the property owners who are claiming that, well, you know, we're not able to collect rents from businesses who, of course, were not allowed to be open. Now, other businesses are citing customers' fears and delivery drivers who don't want to make deliveries in or near the zone as part of the lawsuit. But if that were a valid argument, then the business I work for could also join the lawsuit, even though the company that I work for is located more than 3 miles away on Lower Queen Anne, because of course we had one service technician last week who told us that he was fearful of driving into the city of Seattle. So that's kind of a spurious, you know, citing the fears of customers and citing the fears of delivery drivers. I don't know. But nothing stirs Mayor Durkin off her throne like a threat to the bottom line of Seattle businesses. I just want to point that out. The lawsuit set a deadline for this Friday. That was yesterday. If the city hadn't moved to clean up CHOP by then, the plaintiffs said that they would file for injunctive relief. Now, injunctive relief is when you request a judge to rule that the city must remove the protest zone. Rather than asking for damages, you're asking the judge to make the city do something. So on Friday, shortly after 5 a.m., Seattle Department of Transportation trucks showed up at the protest zone, and SDOT personnel began trying to take down the barriers, but they were stopped by sleepy-eyed protesters who sat on barricades and laid down in the street in front of an SDOT front loader to stop the equipment from going into the zone. SDOT head Sam Zimbabwe, fire chief Harold Scoggins, and personnel from the Seattle Public Utilities and the mayor's office, Stephanie Formas from the mayor's office was there, all tried to negotiate with some of the protesters to reopen streets, but they ended up settling for sending Parks Department personnel into Cal Anderson Park to do a garbage pickup and ask the homeless population if they needed any services. Essentially, SDOT personnel and Seattle Public Utilities personnel were driven off by the protesters. Now, the mainstream media has all been quick to quote an email by one of the folks in the mayor's office saying, protesters were really aggressive towards SDOT personnel, et cetera. But if you watch the live feed from Omari Salisbury's Converge Media, which I highly recommend people do if you really want to know what the protest zone looks like, and maybe you can't break self-isolation or you just want to know what's going on a day when you're at work or something, you watch or listen to the live feed and you can see that actually the protesters were peaceful. They were just peacefully blocking the SDOT personnel from doing their jobs. They were not aggressive. and in the negotiations with SDOT leader Sam Zimbabwe head of the Seattle Public Utilities and Stephanie Formas of the mayor's office, protesters essentially listened and they dialogued and they were peaceful. They might have raised their voices a little bit, but they were not aggressive. Okay. So I'm kind of sick of reading that stuff quoted uncritically by the mainstream media.
Also, and then getting shared nationally.
Yes, and also sick of the mayor's office putting out that kind of misinformation, too. Now, at 3 p.m. yesterday afternoon, Mayor Durkan finally met on neutral ground with a few of the protesters at First African Methodist Episcopal Church at 14th and Pine. Now, I was not in that meeting, but from what I've heard from people who were in that meeting, what they've said is that it really was not a negotiation. It was Mayor Durkan saying, this is what's going to happen. And what she said in that meeting, just a couple of blocks north of the protest zone, is that she would agree to hold off on removing most of the barricades until Sunday morning, but that's when they're going to come down. And she said that the SPD would not return to the East Precinct. She also said that barricades around the East Precinct will remain, but that the remaining streets will have to be opened up for traffic on Sunday, and that SDOT personnel would start that on Sunday morning. Now, the plaintiffs in the lawsuit have therefore agreed to hold off on filing for injunctive relief to give the Durkan administration more time. But I think it remains to be seen if all of the protesters will agree to this, especially since the Durkan administration has not met any of the protesters' three key initial demands, which is one, to defund the SPD by 50%, two, which is to spend those freed up funds on services for Seattle residents and especially for communities of color, and three, to release all of the protesters who've been arrested since the protests began at the end of May. Now, the CHOP has been in existence since the Seattle Police Department spent a terrible week in early May gassing peaceful protesters and residents of the neighborhood around the East Precinct. When the SPD finally abandoned the East Precinct building, and I want to say it's still really unclear who ordered that withdrawal and how that actually took place, that was on June 9th. The protesters then appropriated the police barricades and blocked off an area between Broadway and 13th along the Pike Pine corridor and some of the side streets and alleyways as well. And they also took possession of a large portion of Cal Anderson Park. Anarchists named it the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ for short, but then black activists rechristened it the Capitol Hill Occupation Protests, or CHOP, because they thought, well, for two reasons, because CHAZ sounds like a white frat boy's name, and because they wanted the focus to remain on the message that it's about police brutality, it's about race, institutional racism, and that's what the focus should remain. Now, one of the biggest problems that the city has had with CHOP, and that hasn't been well covered in the mainstream media, they just complain, oh, you know, it's a formless protest, nobody's in charge, blah, blah, blah. But the biggest problem really is that city personnel don't know how to communicate with a group that practices decentralized democracy and consensus decision making, and that lacks a really designated leadership. No one among the city's top personnel is willing or has the patience or the practice to attend strategy sessions, which do happen regularly in Cal Anderson Park, to hear what various protesters and groups within the zone have to say, to respond to their concerns, and to try to reach some kind of agreement with them. If the city stopped asking and mainstream media stopped asking who is in charge here, but asked instead, when do you guys meet? You know, can we sit in? Can we hear what your thoughts are? Can we start to talk? Can we provide some input? Can we start to negotiate with the whole of you?
You mean the things that we're expected to as citizens when we're dealing with the city?
Yes, exactly. Then things would move along a whole lot faster, and both sides would get a whole lot further in getting their demands met. So that's all I have to say about CHOP today.
All right. And if folks want to see...
And if you want to see it, it's still going to be up today. Be aware, though, that, again, as I said, the police have pulled back from a large portion of Lower Capitol Hill, And there are opportunists there who are using it as an opportunity to do criminal activity. There may be some crazies who show up with guns, and I'm not talking about the homeless people there. I'm talking about just crazies in the general population of the city who are either white nationalists or they're just kind of mentally off, who show up with weapons or who show up to challenge people in the protest zone. So just be aware of that. There may be a risk to your safety if you go. Go during the day. Don't go at night. And if you want to also support CHOP, you can start sending people to good news sources about CHOP, and you can start talking about it in terms of, let's focus on the message here. These folks are asking for specific demands from the city, and reiterate what those three key demands are and what some of the associated demands might be.
And again, Converge Media is doing a stellar job. People can check them out online.
Yeah, just Google them online.
And we also, on the KODX Facebook page, posted Omari's summary of yesterday's meeting that you want to check out.
He's kind of been the de facto, he's kind of become the de facto sort of media source for good information inside the zone. He's not the media representative of the protesters in the zone, but he's been kind of a clearinghouse for some of their views.
And he's been there the whole time.
It can be quite fun to watch some of the live streams and some of the folks that he knows, a lot of the people who show up there regularly. He goes around and interviews them on almost a daily basis. It can be quite fun to watch some of those live streams.
And quite stressful at times, too.
Yes, when like I said, crazies show up with weapons, which has been happening more frequently of late.
All right. Moving on, the Mayor Durkan has been working on a revised budget.
Yeah, the mayor released her revised budget for 2020, her proposal this week. What made the news about it is that it contained a 5% annual cut to the Seattle Police Department instead of the 50% cut that protesters have been asking for, because half of the year is already over. That 5% cut will actually be a 10% cut to the rest of the year's budget for the Seattle Police Department. But here's what didn't get really discussed. Most of that $20.3 million in cuts are just funds that won't get spent because of the pandemic, okay, for things like fewer supply orders, fewer in-person training classes, and less overtime for things like policing sporting events, which are not going to happen, summertime concerts, which are not going to happen, and responding to traffic accidents, which we've had many fewer of because we have less traffic on the roads. This accounts for about $16 million of the quote-unquote cuts. All of those were identified before the protests even happened. So those, you could consider those just easy cuts, essentially. The only new cut that Durkan proposed was putting a hold on $4 million that were earmarked, that's been earmarked for a new North Precinct police station, which anti-racism activists have been calling the bunker now for several years. Durkan said that she would institute a hiring freeze for 2021 and ask the Seattle Police Department to identify three scenarios in 2021 that would include cuts of 20%. That's scenario one. Scenario two would be cuts of 30%. And scenario three would be cuts of 50% to the SPD budget in 2021. Now, this is kind of like asking a mortally ill patient to envision how he might heal himself without any medical intervention. The results are not going to be very meaningful in terms of real cuts and a real imagining of what the Seattle Police Department could become. Now, in other highlights of the mayor's budget proposal, the city is expected to have a shortfall of around $300 million total for the rest of this year because of the recession caused by the pandemic. In addition, the city will need to spend an additional $233 million to address COVID-19 in the city of Seattle. To pay for the COVID-19 response, the city is going to use, according to Durkan's proposal, and I'm sure the city council will probably go along with this, they will use a mix of state and federal money from FEMA, the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Relief Fund, various state sources, plus 25% of the city's rainy day and emergency funds, and unspent money redirected from various departments because of the pandemic. For example, fewer supply purchases because people are working from home more, so they don't need pens and pencils and paper and toner and so forth. Less money spent on the motor pool because people are just not, you know, coming to work and then having to drive other places. Less travel, less new furniture and equipment purchases, et cetera, et cetera. All that money can be redirected. All that money that was earmarked to spend on those things can be redirected to COVID-19 response. And support personnel who are not needed by some city departments because all of their colleagues are working from home, therefore they don't need to even be working necessarily. Those folks have been authorized to switch instead to work on the COVID-19 response, what Durkin has called redirected resources. Now, to plug the revenue hole, the city will institute a hiring freeze across all its departments for the rest of the year and reduce overtime expenses. Some levy money earmarked for improvements will also be used instead for basic operations, freeing up general fund money that would be spent for those basic operations to plug the budget hole. Now, this is going to require a separate vote by the city council to approve that. That levy money includes $10 million from the Move Seattle levy that would have been spent on transportation improvements, $10 million from the Parks District, again, spent on new parks and park improvements, $2 million from the families and preschool levy, which would have expanded preschool and other resources in the city of Seattle, and $1.6 million from the library levy, again, money that would have been used to expand resources in the public library system. That money's all going to be redirected from new improvements into just basic operations for those departments. And the city won't spend money allocated for consultants, some contracts, equipment and technology purchases, and the neighborhood matching fund. In addition, most city departments will take a budget cut of some kind, except there's one exception, the Human Services Department, which is expanding to handle the COVID-19 response. And I should add the Police Department, which is not taking a meaningful cut. It is simply taking, quote unquote, shadow cuts, which are money they really can't spend because there's not a need for those services. And that $4 million that would have gone into siting and building the new North Precinct station. So the SPD is not taking any meaningful cuts either. Now, there are no new revenue sources, no new taxes or fees in Durkin's budget proposal for the rest of the year, primarily because, and this is because you can't really institute a new fee and collect the money in time to be able to spend it in 2020. Now, she also laid out a strategy for 2021, a sort of preview of what she's going to propose in the fall for next year's budget. She's hoping to use the remaining 75% of the rainy day and emergency funds for next year to renegotiate labor contracts with city personnel to lower salaries, lay off some city staff, cut all city departments between 5 to 10%, and this is a direct quote from her slide, advocacy for new state and federal resources, end quote. And I just have to say good luck with that last one. You better hope that Joe Biden gets elected and not Donald Trump. In addition, her 2021 strategy says, quote, these strategies alone will be insufficient to rebalance. New revenues or additional cost savings will be needed to balance the 2021 budget. Likely, it will need to be a combination of both, end quote. But then again, she makes no mention of where new revenue should come from. So that's been left to the city council. Teresa Mosqueda this week introduced her new payroll tax bill with Lisa Herbold, Lorena Gonzalez, Dan Strauss, and Andrew Lewis co-sponsoring. This means that she already has a majority of the council supporting that bill. It also appears that she's already worked out a deal with Shama Sawant and Tammy Morales to have Mosqueda's bill be the base proposal, the base payroll tax proposal that the council is going to work on this year. And so Tammy Morales is already drafting amendments to Mosqueda's bill to bring it a little closer to the Sawant-Morales proposal, including one that would raise the amount of money it collects and another that would change the automatic 10-year sunset in Mosqueda's bill to apply only if the county or state, or to apply If the county or state does not pass a revenue bill that allocates the same amount of money to the city of Seattle. So essentially making that sunset clause conditional on the city and state taking action. Now, Mosqueda's tax called Jumpstart Seattle, I just want to remind people of what it is, would impose a payroll tax on businesses with payrolls over $7 million. Those businesses would have to pay a 0.7% tax on any salaries that fall between $150,000 and $499,999. For salaries of $500,000 and higher, the businesses would pay a higher executive rate of 1.4%. For businesses with payroll over $1 billion total, the two rates would be double. They'd be 1.4% and 2.1%. And although Mosqueda didn't say, you know, which businesses those would apply to, we can envision Amazon as probably the one business who definitely has over $1 billion in payroll taxes in payroll in the city of Seattle.
And apparently enough money to get the naming rights on the
new hockey arena
stadium.
Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, if something goes wrong with Mosqueda's bill, Sawant and Morales still have the Citizens Initiative that would put their bill on the November ballot for voters to decide. So it's like they're holding that card in reserve. But my guess is they're not going to turn in the signatures unless they feel that they need to. So we will see how that plays out in the next couple of weeks. Andrew Lewis also said this week that he will introduce his separate capital gains tax bill this coming Monday. He's just waiting for the city attorney's office to finish reviewing it and giving him their feedback on the bill. So,
and that's in addition to the other.
To the Mosqueda bill.
It's not competing with them.
It's not competing separate. It would be an additional tax on top. And I just want to remind people, too, we talked about this last week, but Teresa Mosqueda's bill is a bill on businesses. It would tax businesses. Okay, the businesses would have to pay those taxes. They would not come out of your paycheck. Individuals would not pay those taxes. Andrew Lewis's bill, on the other hand, is a tax on households. So individuals would pay that tax. And it would not apply to real estate and to people's pensions. It's just and retirement accounts. I just want to remind people of that. So that's my coverage of the city budget this week.
Well, and Council President Gonzalez also came out this week in support of cutting SPD budget by 50%.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was so it's pretty not, dramatic when yeah, the city council president comes out.
We're going to talk about this a little bit later, too. But I think counties and municipalities and states, even the federal government, pours way too much money into bringing down the hammer, law enforcement, rather than services up front, which are well known to prevent crime in the first place. If you provide a way out of poverty, if you provide opportunities for folks who are at the margins, then you have less crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and if you base your economy around making hammers, then clearly hammers are going to be what you use to address every solution, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you have to have other things going. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be overspending on the hammers and there's going to be this blowback. It's going to be this pushback from people.
All right. But we're not done with city council yet.
Nope,
they actually had some
there was
good
other
news this week.
Legislation. On Monday, the city council voted on Andrew Lewis's two bills to repeal two loitering laws. One supposedly for drug loitering and the other supposedly for prostitution loitering. And I use the word supposedly because even though that's how what the bills say, they're often those laws are often used against people of color and poor people, ways in which those folks are discriminated against. Those bills are used as an excuse to put them in handcuffs and haul them to jail, even when they haven't really done anything except look suspicious to the police. Now, anti-racism and anti-poverty activists have long complained that these laws have been used to harass people of color and poor people in the city of Seattle, as well as nationwide. The city attorney's office has mostly stopped prosecuting people charged under these two laws in recent years, particularly the last couple of years. Instead, programs like the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, or LEAD program, have helped people arrested for drug dealing, drug possession, petty theft, and prostitution to get services that would move them off the street and into legitimate jobs, housing, and drug treatment programs. Social justice activists have also pushed the city to decriminalize some behaviors, like marijuana possession. That's probably the most common one we know of right now. Marijuana use and possession has become decriminalized in the state of Washington and in the city of Seattle. Other personal drug use, like using heroin, for example, there's been pushback from activists that the city provide services to those folks to help them get clean or to help them get onto an alternative that will keep them off of more dangerous drugs like fentanyl that can cause a high number of deaths in the population that is addicted in the city of Seattle. And also to decriminalize prostitution, which would allow the city to regulate prostitution, would provide some health and safety protections to girls on the street, and would allow them to form a union to get them out of the hands of Johns and out of the hands of dangerous pimps, and would also allow the city to prevent underage girls from entering the trade as well. So those are things that activists have been pushing for a long time, and the city finally took the steps.
And when we say activists, we mean primarily people of color.
Yes, primarily people of color. I mean,
they've been the driving force behind this.
Mm-hmm. And I should say not just activists, but community members in communities of color have been pushing for these things as well. In addition, the money that the city spends to jail people for things like petty theft, drug dealing, and prostitution could be much better spent on lifting people out of poverty, since, as I said, poverty is the basis for crimes like these.
Huh.
Yeah. So some good news out of the city council this week.
Yeah, that was city council has been a busy place. And again,
they've been stepping up. I mean, I know the national media, I know that Mayor Durkin's office regularly puts out press releases and nasty emails saying the city council doesn't do anything. That's because the city council doesn't do anything on Mayor Durkin's criminal justice proposals they're doing things that Mayor Durkin's office doesn't agree with. It's important to look at the city council and to see what they're doing. They are, in fact, stepping up.
And they have regular meetings that one can watch online and both listen to and or watch.
If you have internet access. And yeah. I want to point out that I think it's around 60,000 to 70,000 households in the city of Seattle do not have internet access. That's another way in which poor families and families of color are separated from those of us who have privilege in society.
Yeah, the haves and have-nots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
so if you do have internet access, you can take part in those meetings.
Definitely. And they usually, if you're going to be making comments, people generally line up like online, mm-hmm. Sign in like hours, like about 2 hours ahead of time if you want to get into the queue there. Get there too late and you're not going to make it for that day.
But you can observe.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Always very, very helpful.
And they're also all archived as well. So you can, again, you need internet access to do so. Mm-hmm. But again, these resources are available.
On the city's
website.
And
we've been airing some of it, too, in the 6 o'clock slot in the beginning of the week, during the last couple of weeks. So something corporate media maybe ought to think about.
You can often see these meetings on cable TV. So if you have TV but you don't have internet access,
that's actually not as true as it used to be.
Well, I've seen some city council meetings on cable.
Yeah,
on the Seattle
but
Channel,
but not nearly as much as they did once upon a time. Once the Seattle Channel basically sucked up all the money away from public access, they
started airing a lot of entertainment programs.
Yeah, they
instead.
Moved and become an entertainment channel. All right, but enough about that.
Okay, don't
get me going.
Yeah,
on that.
Get us going on independent media and media in general in Seattle, and we'll go forever.
Being chopped to pieces as we speak.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on the Seattle School Board.
Yeah, the Seattle School Board took an important vote this week. They voted to rid Seattle schools of police. Now, it was a unanimous vote on Wednesday to put the Seattle Schools partnership with the Seattle Police Department on indefinite hold. That partnership involves five Seattle Police Department officers stationed in Central and South Seattle schools that have very racially diverse student bodies. Those schools are South Shore PK-8, the Aki Kurosi Middle School, Denny International Middle School, Washington Middle School, and Garfield High School. In the last school year, the Seattle School District paid the Seattle Police Department around $120,000 for that program. So it's rent-a-cop to the Seattle schools, essentially, and only to schools with large populations of Black, Latino, and Asian students. Originally, the proposal was to put the program on hold for 1 year, but a petition organized by the group WABLOC, which stands for Washington Building Leaders of Change, they're a group that advocates for a progressive, empowering education for students in South Seattle. They called for an end to Seattle police presence in schools. The school board listened, and three members, Chandra Hampson, Zachary DeWolf, and Brandon Hersey, introduced a stronger proposal that also includes a provision to use unarmed officers at district events, calls for the superintendent to develop a Black Studies curriculum. Time was, the schools had a Black Studies curriculum, but not anymore. I think the Reagan Revolution was partially about eliminating access to by students of color to their own history. And the proposal calls for the district to set clear protocols for when a teacher should call police. For example, to eliminate situations in which white teachers can call police because a Black student has just mouthed off, you know, not really, and is not really a threat. Now, in addition, at least some of that $120,000 that the Seattle schools have been spending on police in these five schools should be used to bring counselors back into Seattle schools to help students who are struggling or who are having problems at home. I have to say, again, if you have to choose between a certified counselor or a cop to talk to your child when they need help, who are you going to choose? I think just about everybody's going to want a counselor to talk to their child at least first before they have somebody call a cop. Okay. And in addition, a lot of the officers who have been doing work, a lot of those police officers who have been doing work in the Seattle schools and who are protesting the end of this program are citing the fact that they do a lot of counseling to students in those schools. And I just have to say, again, you know, should the police be doing that? Shouldn't certified counselors be doing that? Okay. And this idea that the schools can continually cut access to medical personnel in schools, access to counselors, access to things like counseling on job training, you know, for students of color, cutting ASL teachers, you know, or ESL teachers, you know, helping students who have disabilities, helping students for whom English is their second language, those cannot be negotiable anymore. Those are resources that are required. And I think that that's going to be the next lawsuit when it comes to our state schools. You know, not just ensuring that the schools are adequately funded, but are you providing the services students need? You know? So I think this was a really good step by the Seattle School Board, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah. And again, this is something that's been a long
time coming.
Yeah.
Because there's been lots of fights about it. Yes.
I can remember when I was a kid, they did have counselors. There was a nurse in every school. Mm-hmm. That was just normal, you know, multiple counselors, nurse.
Yes, we had support. In my school, we had four vice principals, and their main role was to act as counselors for students, to serve as school security, and to help break up fights. They essentially, you know, they did the job that police are doing in schools now, and that's insane.
All right, moving on, some updates on the local COVID-19 situation.
Yeah, Washington State has had a total of 30,855 positive cases with over 1,300 deaths. But our state's looking good compared to the rest of the United States. Now, the total number of tests for COVID-19 in Washington State is at 514,428. But Washington has a population of over 7.6 million people. Okay, so we're still very, very far away from having universal testing and contact tracing here.
And when you say tests, I'm assuming some of those 500,000 have had...
Exactly. Yeah, some of those are people who've had more than one test. I still think
the majority of people have not been tested.
Yeah, we are very far from universal testing, the kind of testing that you need to fully open your economy. Now, while some Western Washington counties are starting to move into phase two, and that includes King County, Yakima County has 6,759 positive cases. That's second only to King County in Washington State. And that's why Governor Inslee has ordered all residents of Yakima County to wear face masks at all time in public. Now, Governor Inslee has also this week ordered Washington residents to wear face masks in public whenever possible, because telling people that they should wear face masks clearly isn't a strong enough message. Now, it seems to, I think, for a lot of people come across as a mixed message to tell King County that you can go to phase two, but at the same time to have the governor say everyone must wear face masks in public. People see that as a mixed message, and I want to kind of parse that for you and kind of untangle it a little bit so that you can understand it and you can communicate it to your friends and family, okay? Because this is really important. We're going to phase two because case numbers have been dropping off and hospitals are looking good in terms of having a lot of capacity to treat people who have ordinary illnesses as well as people with COVID-19. And there's pressure from businesses that are suffering and work and residents who are suffering because they're not working right now and need money to move to reopen the economy, okay? To do that safely, some protections have to be in place. People have to continue to socially distance as much as they possibly can. They must wear face masks in public. They must. And they must continue to wash their hands. So opening up to phase two does not mean we can all take off our masks and go enjoy the sun and gather together in groups and, you know, have parties, et cetera. It means we must be more vigilant to make sure that we're wearing our face masks when we're around other people, which in the city of Seattle, I must remind people, in cities like Seattle, Spokane, Vancouver, Washington, in Tacoma, we're just too dense. There's just too much density for us to take off our face masks, even when we're outdoors. So Governor Inslee said, when you're indoors or out, when you're around other people, you have to wear your face mask, okay? And I can't stress that enough. Now, King County has seen a 47% uptick in cases, mostly in young adults and Seattle residents. I think this is because a lot of people have been interpreting the move to phase one. Phase two was just Friday. The move to phase one means that they could ditch their masks and go meet with their friends and have parties and sit in bars and drink and so forth, or make cocktails at home with all their friends in one room without face masks. That is absolutely not the case, and that is not what phase one means. Phase two means that restaurants and bars, hair and nail salons, barbershops, tattoo parlors, and pet groomers can operate at half capacity, and people must wear their face masks and wash hands and maintain at 6 feet, if at all possible. Retail stores can allow in-store shopping at 30% capacity, again, with those protections in place. And domestic service workers, factory workers, and construction workers can return to work as long as they keep their personal protection in place, face masks, hand washing, 6 foot distances. As for your social life, this is the key. One gathering per week with no more than five people from outside your household, and you have to maintain 6 feet of distance and wear a mask and wash your hands. Okay. Now I know people think, well, because I'm maintaining the 6 feet, I can take off my mask. Not if you're indoors. And if you're outdoors in a big city, people are going to walk within that 6-foot radius. You can guarantee it. So if you're in a city, it's and maintain 6 feet and wear a mask and wash your hands. Okay. Now, I've seen a lot of people, especially young people, violating those rules. I bet I see people of all ages doing it. Mm-hmm. Mostly I see this in local restaurants with outdoor tables where people are sitting in groups, obviously not people in their own household, at the same table, well within 6 feet of each other, not wearing masks, having loud, happy discussions together, you know, because they're eating and drinking. And I think this is a big mistake, allowing restaurants and bars to open and to have in restaurant and in bar service. I think that is the biggest mistake.
Well, in Seattle, I believe they're pushing legislation or changes towards supporting restaurants so that they can have more outdoor seating.
More outdoor seating.
Again, and where are you going to do that? You're going to do that on the sidewalks.
On the streets where people are walking by.
Yeah, and for those of us that are trying to maneuver down those sidewalks, that can be quite
the
challenge.
I think the city should investigate closing more streets, actually, particularly in these districts that have a lot of restaurants and bars. I'm sympathetic to those restaurant and bar owners who have been kind of sitting on their hands and not able to pay their bills. I really am sympathetic to that. On the other hand, you know, you don't want your business to be a COVID-19 hotspot. You really don't. So we have to be thinking about that. We have to be cautious about that. Now, I've also seen it in places like city parks where there are signs posted that literally say, cover up. You are required to wear a mask when you're on city property. That's what the signs say. And yet, if you go inside a city park, like I was in the Seattle Center last weekend before the phase two opening, and I saw less than a third of the people in the park wearing face masks. You know, they thought, we're outdoors, you know, we're having a good time, it's not a problem, we can take off our masks. But the instant you have to untangle your dog from another dog and you're within 6 feet of the other dog owner, you know, there you are. People, it's like pregnancy, okay? It only takes once, you know? It only takes one time and you're infected, okay?
Yeah.
You
can't be a little bit pregnant.
You can't be a little bit pregnant or a little bit sick. Yeah. You know, it only takes one time. Now, although stores and businesses, and I've seen this too, although stores and businesses, a lot of them have had signs posted requiring people to wear masks, there is no enforcement. You know, and so you go inside the grocery store and you do see people without their masks on. Those people need to go home and someone needs to tell them, go home, put your mask on or take your mask out of your purse. You know, and put it on. Do you have a bandana? Do you have a scarf? Do you have something that you can put over your face? King County had its first spike in March and early April. That was the first spike in the coronavirus infections. Let's hope that this reopening doesn't kick us into a second spike. And I just want to say to people that it's really, really important to understand that you can be carrying the virus and not have symptoms. And this is true for people of all ages. Doesn't matter how old you are, you could be symptomless. In fact, George Stephanopoulos said this week that he had tested positive for COVID-19 after his wife became ill, and he's feeling fine. He had zero symptoms. He's older. He's an older person. So he's in the high-risk group. Zero symptoms, and yet he's a carrier. Didn't know it until he got tested. And because not everyone is getting tested, we need to just assume we're all carriers, you know, until we know otherwise. And the face mask wearing only works if we all do it. You're not wearing a face mask to protect yourself. You're protecting other people from your own exhalations, okay? And you don't know if you're infected. Literally, I'm saying that. You think you're not infected. You don't know. You just don't know unless you've had a test and you've gotten the results very recently. You don't know. You don't know the person who just walked by you is infected. You don't know if the person in front or behind you in the grocery store line is infected. You don't know if the cashier is infected. None of you know. Okay? And the only way this works is if we have as close to 100% compliance as we can with wearing face masks, washing hands, and staying as far apart from each other as we can. Okay. Right. I spent a lot of time on that, but that's really important.
But across the U.S., the numbers are climbing.
There's been a huge surge in COVID-19 cases across the United States, particularly in states that have been reopening. Texas and Florida, the governors are setting new limits now. They're resetting limits on what people can do, particularly on bars and restaurants where coronavirus clusters have appeared. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom reimposed a stay-at-home order on the rural Imperial County. That's just east of San Diego. It's an agricultural, primarily Latino population county in California. That's another big COVID-19 hotspot. And I want to just say about people of color, they have been made up a large percentage of the victims of COVID-19 so far, a large number of the hospitalizations and a large number of the deaths. And this is primarily because they make up a large number of the necessary workers in our economy right now. I just want to remind people, you know, grocery store workers, meatpacking plants, people in warehouses, distribution centers, largely people of color, people who are the delivery drivers who bring you your goods that you order online, you know, people who clean buildings, residences, businesses that are open, those are people of color, people who prepare food for takeout, largely people of color. And those folks,
people who pick the food.
Yeah, people who pick the food, who grow the food. This is why Yakima County here in Washington State has become a COVID-19 hotspot. You know, those are folks who don't have a lot of benefits. They don't make a lot of money, so they can't afford to stay home, even if they weren't necessary workers. They're not, a lot of them are working in industries that don't have a high margin. That's particularly true in restaurant work and in agricultural work. So the business owners can't spend a whole lot of money on providing them protective equipment. And a lot of times the work is hot and arduous. Like restaurant work can be really hot and sweaty. Agricultural work can be hot and arduous and sweaty even before you put on a face mask and gloves. Okay, so and a lot of times when you go home, that when you get to your truck, you take off that face mask, you take off those gloves, and then maybe you want to stop by the bar. you gotta go to the grocery store. You really don't want to put that face mask on, and that's, you know, and a lot of these folks, particularly workers in the agricultural industry, they're living in crowded conditions. So they go home, they're exposed, you know? So it's just been really, really hard on communities of color to deal with this. And they make up a lot of the new cases. Now, Friday saw 45,000 new cases in the United States. That's the third day in a row of a daily record number of new cases in the United States. This week, Dr. Anthony Fauci, he's the director of the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, he told Congress in a hearing that the United States has not reached, much less past, its initial peak in the pandemic. So talking about a second peak makes no sense right now. We are still in the first peak. Six states posted daily records of new cases on Friday, including Florida, Idaho, Kansas, Oregon, our neighbor to the south, South Carolina, and Utah. Other states reporting record highs this week include California, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, Missouri, Oklahoma, Nevada, and Alaska. In other states that are reopening, cases are back on the upswing after trending downward for weeks. As of Friday, a total of 29 states saw an upswing in new cases this week. That's the vast majority of states in the United States. So clearly, testing and contact tracing is not working. It's not broad enough yet to work, which is why mask wearing and social distancing has to continue. It has to become universal, and it has to go on probably through the end of this year, at least until we have a vaccine. And that's not going to come at the earliest until early 2021. Okay. And like I've been saying, it only works if we all do it all the time. And it's just important to remember that if you see someone and know someone who's not wearing a mask and not following the protocols, you need to talk to them. Be nice, be friendly, but just remind them it only works if we're all doing it.
All right. leaves us just 5 minutes. Did you want to talk about the New York Times article?
I do, just briefly. The New York Times had a great article this week entitled, How Do the Police Actually Spend Their Time? That was the title of the article. The Times looked at data posted by some large metropolitan police departments that's posted online, including the city of Seattle was in there. And all of these departments had one thing in common. Police use about 4% of their time to handle violent crimes like murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. Just 4%, and in some cases it's just under 4%. Serious violent crimes are about 1% of the calls that are made to police in any given year. In Seattle, responses to traffic accidents account for 15% of calls to the Seattle Police Department. Other reasons that police are frequently called include domestic disputes, mental health crises, missing person complaints, noise complaints, and providing security for events like school functions, sporting events, and outdoor concerts, etc., and indoor concerts. Even non-fatal shootings are a tiny percent of what the police do. When grouped with fatal gun homicides, shootings in total make up about 0.7% of the calls to police departments. So it's a really good question to ask. Why can't social workers and counselors do a big chunk of that work? I mean, a big, big chunk of that work. And another big chunk could be done by unarmed security personnel. Okay? You do not have to send a guy with a gun to everything. That's the point that anti-racism protesters and anti-police brutality protesters have been making, and they are absolutely right about that. And I think a 50% cut in the police department is probably conservative, maybe, if we really start looking at what the police spend their time on. Do we have enough time to talk about Donald Trump?
Yep,
suspending. Okay, sure. Donald Trump this week suspended new visas for foreign workers. A very popular immigration program for U.S. businesses is the H-1B visa program that allows U.S. companies to bring technically skilled foreign workers to the United States. Trump has long promised that his immigration policies would be merit-based, that he would not bar educated, technically skilled workers from entering the United States, and he broke that promise this week. On Monday, he temporarily suspended any new work visas for hundreds of thousands of jobs, literally over 500,000, including H-1B visas, H-2B visas, which cover seasonal workers in the hospitality industry, including workers employed by his own companies in his hotels and resorts, and students on work-study programs at universities. He also suspended visas for companies with employees at their foreign branches who might want to bring those employees to the U.S. for training or for promotion. In addition, he blocked the ability for foreign workers who are already in the United States to bring their spouses here, which is absolutely inhuman. This is expected to affect, as I said, over 500,000 people through the end of this year alone. And I think I did mention that Donald Trump has taken advantage of the H-2B visa program for his own business. Now, this comes after Trump signed an executive order in April that suspended for 60 days issuing any new green cards to foreign people who want to work in the United States. At that time, he had assured businesses that he would not touch the H-1B and H-2B visa programs. But on Monday, when he extended the ban on green cards, he also added in a ban on H-1B and H-2B visas. The practical outcome of this is that most of the U.S. business community is now going to be backing Joe Biden for election in November. And I think we're starting to see that because Biden reported raising a record $80.8 million in May for his campaign. That's $7 million more than the Trump campaign did in May. Trump still has an enormous war chest, but last weekend's shoddy showing at his campaign rally in Tulsa could be a sign that, money or not, Trump is on his way out, and the American people are just in a slow motion process of firing him, I think.
All right. So we've been talking with Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, and we're still working on getting Jav pulled into the mix here, but, you know, fingers crossed, it's a process.
Fingers crossed, Jav will have his internet access back up and working so that we can bring him in remotely.
All right.
He will not be traveling to the station. Not until there's a vaccine. And
we won't let him even if he wants to.
And Mike and I definitely have immunity.
All right. So we can plan on hearing from you again next week.
Yes, I'll be here next week.
All right.